seated, please.
Court is ready to hear argument in 060890, Neighbors Drilling USA, Inc. versus Francisca Escoto.
Please the court. Ms. Francisca will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice Jefferson, Justices of the Court, may it please the Court. An easy answer in this appeal is that the respondents are relying upon the wrong case. They disavow reliance on Otis Engineering in their brief, frankly, because they can't meet the elements of Otis, and Otis wasn't submitted in the jury charge below. Instead, they rely exclusively on D. Houston, Inc. versus Love. But Love has not been applied in a third-party situation. This court had the opportunity to do so in Lorem Maintenance of Way, which involved a third party, a police officer, shot by an employee who was strung out on methamphetamine, and the court held no duty, never citing D. Houston, Inc. versus Love, but citing Otis Engineering, because Otis Engineering is the law of this state in these kinds of circumstances when a claim is brought by a third party. And the holding in Love was specifically limited to a duty recognized to an independent contractor for her own injuries. And the court noted that we do not need to decide whether Otis Engineering applies in such a situation. So two levels of argument on duty in this case are, should the court extend D. Houston, Inc. versus Love from a first party, if you will, case to a third party case? And whether Love should also be extended from intoxication to working a 12-hour night shift. And the answer to both of those questions is no. The court's duty analysis is correct. When the plaintiff is a third party with whom the defendant has no relationship, it is altogether proper to employ the two-step elements in Otis Engineering, as opposed to the duty analysis that was applied in D. Houston, Inc. versus Love. So, in this case, they're simply relying upon a case that does not apply to their class of plaintiffs. The other issue is whether the court should equate intoxication with working a 12-hour night shift. And the answer, again, is no. On a very global level, we know that the law does not treat those as the same. If you spend 12 hours at the night drinking at a bar and then get in your car, you can be arrested. If you spend 12 hours working at a night shift, you can't be arrested just because you've done that. The law treats them very differently. And specifically, if you look at the duty factors that this court has applied in Greater Houston Transportation and all of the cases since then, each one of the duty factors argues against recognizing a duty in this case. The first one being foreseeability. In Jenkins versus Kimlon, the court noted that there is not as great a degree of foreseeability of injury when you have someone who works long hours as opposed to someone who is intoxicated. The Supreme Court of Wyoming, in the Killian case we cite, said that the foreseeability is not as high when you have someone working long hours, but there is provided for them, as in this case, sleeping quarters that they can go to after work.
And the quarters are designed solely for that purpose? Is that the sole purpose behind them, for people to rest?
It's described by the witnesses as the employees are told, this is your home away from home. You treat this as your home, you stay there, and that they are encouraged that if they're too tired, they stay in those premises. Sometimes, of course, they're working the day shift. Sometimes they're working the night shift.
Does the record show how often they're utilized?
There's nothing in the record that shows what percentage of the time. Now, in the case of Mr. Ambriz, he always had stayed in the quarters because previous jobs had been pretty far from home. When he had this assignment to McCook, which was about an hour drive from Raymondville, this is the first time that he had gone home. But I think the gist of the testimony is that the quarters were available. He enjoyed the quarters. He reported to his parents that they were well equipped. So this court also, in the Goodyear case versus Mays, said that mere knowledge of long hours and long commute doesn't equate to driver incompetence or recklessness for negligent entrustment purposes. So there is a difference on the foreseeability angle as far as the duty is concerned. Then you turn to the policy considerations, and here there's a vast difference. There is, of course, no social utility to requiring an exotic dancer getting drunk with customers. In this case, however, there is a great social utility in our society, which is a 24/7 society these days, to having shift work, to having people working at night. There's a utility to the employer, there's a utility to employees who want to earn a living, and there's a utility to society. Then you look at the factor of the burden on the defendant. And the burden here would be very great. First of all, because it's very hard to tell whether somebody is too fatigued to drive home. It's a process of identification, and there's so many variables. Some days I can be sleepy after working 6 hours. Some days I can work 14 hours and I'm still wide awake, maybe depending on what I did the night before, which is another consideration in this case. And some people require more sleep, some people less sleep. So it would be very hard for an employer to determine whether someone's too sleepy. And even if they did, what control does the employer have? The employee is off duty. Is it suggested here that the employer can capture the employee and keep them from leaving? I think that would be absurd and would be beyond what the employer has the power to do. I suppose you'd have to then require the employer to pay them for sleeping a certain period of time. Those are just factors that show that the burden would be too great, that there would be no control. And there would be economic consequences, far-reaching economic consequences. Indirectly, the respondents are asking this court to regulate work hours based upon testimony given by an expert in one single case, when this is a legislative activity, not denying that there can be problems from sleep deprivation and driving while sleepy, but these are things that the legislatures can deal with and can deal with in legislation, and it's not proper for the tort system to deal with. And for all those reasons, the duty analysis stacks up that there should be no duty recognized in this case. The only other argument that they make is duty to train. They cite a number of negligent hiring cases dealing with people who were shot or raped or assaulted, and those aren't training cases. You don't have to train people not to shoot others or not to assault others. The only training case that they cite is Allen versus AT&T Transportation. And in that case, the employee said, "You didn't train me how to drive my truck. I didn't know how to drive a truck that has liquid in it that's going to slosh around and cause my truck to tump over." The court held that there was no duty in that case. That's a little bit beside the point, but the point is that the argument in that case was that you have a duty to train me about doing my work. There is no authority that says employers have a duty to train their employees on how they conduct themselves out of work.
Is there evidence of a pattern of fatigue-related injuries on the work site or in automobile accidents when employees left in this case?
If you mean in this particular case, has there been any study about neighbors drilling and yes. The activities around the various job sites? I don't believe there's anything in the record on that. They did present Dr. Samuel Shiflett, who had some statistics from various studies talking about guesstimates about how often sleep
asking,
deprivation.
Yeah, but in prior incidents, is there any evidence in this record that an injury at the workplace or after an employee left was causally related to fatigue?
Well, the only other thing that I can think of is McNeil versus Neighbors Drilling, which is another case that dealt with Neighbors Drilling, and the court there found that there was no duty. There is no authority saying an employer has a duty to train people on how they act outside the workplace, and there is no authority in Texas for training on open and obvious dangers. It is obvious that you shouldn't drive when you're asleep. His mother said, "I didn't want him to drive when he was too tired." All of the workers there knew the sleeping craters were there for purposes of sleeping if you needed to. He was told that morning by Larry Denning, his co-worker, He thought he might be, that Mr. Ambrose might be more tired than he thinks. You've worked 12 hours. Why don't you stay in the trailer? And he didn't do that. This is common knowledge. What they are trying to argue is that the employer should educate people about the various studies that are out there and the facts and information and theories that underlie this danger. But that's not talking about a new and different danger. That's talking about some studies. And in fact, some of the information is conflicting, because part of the studies say that your first shift back of the graveyard is not going to disrupt your circadian rhythm. And that would give then Mr. Ambrose a green light, because this was his first night back. So there's conflicting information, and it doesn't get to a new and different danger.
How would your analysis and conclusion change, if at all, if Mr. Ambrose was driving a company truck and going to another company site with a delivery?
Well, if he was in the course and scope of employment, that would be a different thing, because then the employer can exercise control. Now, you still have the issue of whether you have to train people about normal incidents of their job. In fact, I think in the Mathern case, I think that was Justice Edelman, said there's no duty to train people about how to drive around and obey the normal rules of the road if there's nothing complex or unusually dangerous about it. But it's a difference if he's on duty, then there would be some control in line. And be responding at superior, so you really wouldn't have this issue come up. It would really be an impossible burden for employers to come up with every fact that might be relevant to some known danger. And in fact, this court, in a case I don't think anyone cited, American Tobacco versus Grinnell, 951 Southwest 2nd, page 420, the court said addiction to cigarettes is something new and different from having some disease, lung cancer or whatever, from tobacco. And so maybe that's something that you need to warn separately about. But here we're not talking about some separate danger. We may be talking about the nature and extent of the danger, some aspects of the danger, but it is open and obvious. This court's decision in Caterpillar versus Shears wouldn't have been any different if there had been evidence in there of how often rollover accidents happen, or that people don't realize big, heavy equipment can roll over. Wilhelm versus Flores wouldn't have been any different if there had been evidence that how many people are allergic to bee stings, or how many people don't know that they could be allergic to bee stings. The court simply said there is no duty because open, obvious, and dangerous. And there's no causation here. This is a 19-year-old boy, young man, who had promised his girlfriend he was going to drive her to school. Drive her to school. Larry Denning, this is volume 4, pages 103 to 105. Larry Denning said, you ought to stay at the trader. And he wasn't going to stay at the trader. He said, you've been working all night, stay at the trader. So nothing was going to keep him. No educational programs, no public service announcements were going to dissuade him. And in fact, the other side's expert agreed that the studies show that young men are usually not going to follow this kind of advice. They're going to go ahead and decide that they can drive whether they're sleepy or not. And that's pretty much a known fact. So there's also no causation from the theory of failure to train, a theory that doesn't apply. So in short, there's no basis for an employer warning about an open, obvious risk that's encountered outside the workplace when it's probably not going to do any good anyway. And so there's nothing wrong with telling people that. There's nothing wrong with Mr. Balderas, for instance, saying you ought to be careful going home, but to make that a tort duty is beyond any justification under Texas law. There are other issues that we brief concerning the expert in the case and why his testimony should not be admitted. And there's issues that I think are fully briefed on the damages. I believe this is a no-duty case. I don't think this is an expert admissibility case, although I think that he reasoned backwards, not having enough information, Dr. Shiflett did, to come up with a theory that this was caused by sleepiness. But I think this is a no-duty case where the court, we ask that the court provide guidance on these issues. The Corpus Christi Court of Appeals reached a holding that's contrary to its own precedent, as well as the precedent of virtually every case, if not every case, that has addressed analogous facts. And for those reasons, the judgment notwithstanding the verdict should be reinstated.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Miller will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. want to focus on this duty issue with basically two steps. The first step is to talk about what the case is not, being the Otis case, and the second step to talk about why fatigue is something that you create in your employment conditions. You can't have a duty for that. With regard to the Otis issue, which also they're making in oral argument now, a statement with regard to the Lorem versus Yanni case and saying that that's like Love, let me explain what the distinctions of the cases are. And this is a major distinction in the case, and it's a major distinction in understanding why courts have come to the decisions they have in some of these other cases. In Otis, the employer did not cause the employee to be impaired. In Iani, the employer did not cause the employee to be impaired. One was drug, the other was alcohol.
That's not entirely so, because there's the record in Iani showed that the methamphetamines were supplied by some people within the company. So that isn't that accurate?
That is accurate, but the company, as a work condition, did not cause the impairment of the employee.
Well, it may have had something. There was some testimony in that case where that's so. That they wanted these workers to stay awake longer, so they encouraged them to take these drugs.
We can go with that fact, but I don't think that the ultimate holding in that was the same, because what the court came to was that you didn't have to have the knowledge of employment because you were looking at an Otis Engineering type situation.
Well, notice the employer took an affirmative stance to place the employee in the vehicle, and therefore.
Exactly.
Creating the duty.
Exactly. And in those cases, what was happening was in Otis, what the employer did was it didn't create the impairment, but it created a duty when it took that step of putting the employee, taking control of the employee that it knew was impaired, and then putting that employee on the roadway.
So what would you require to discharge that duty? That, because I guess you'd be on constructive notice that after working a graveyard shift, your employees are going to be tired. Would an employer then have to mandate that they stay on the premises and sleep a certain number of hours before they go on the road? Or would you require an actual knowledge that someone was falling asleep? How would you impose this duty on an employer?
Your Honor, the way the duty was imposed and what was talked about in this case on the facts based on the experts in the industry is that what would be required would be to have a place to sleep, which they had, and essentially training of the employees so that they would understand and make an informed decision about what they were doing, that they would understand the fatigue on them.
Why did this guy not know that driving while you're tired and falling asleep behind the wheel is dangerous? Surely he knew that.
Your Honor, actually, we don't know exactly what he knew because, unfortunately, he died. But can we all say, oh, well, sure, we know that you shouldn't drive while you're sleepy. But the training goes to more than that. What the training goes to is teaching people how to understand why they're in the condition, to understand that fatigue is equal to alcohol intoxication, which most people don't know. And this 19-year-old probably didn't know. His father stated during trial that he didn't know that.
Is this duty, is it restricted to certain employers or all employers? I mean, sometimes we have our clerks working overtime, and do we have a duty then to bring someone here to train them about fatigue?
It's
a universal duty?
I think that it depends on how we define duties. In this case, we're talking about a particularized duty on this employer who decided to work graveyard shifts of manual labor.
If it works for you, why wouldn't it work for everybody? We can't write a rule that just says drilling companies have to warn people about when the employees are tired and get off and drive home.
Not just drilling companies, Your Honor, but you can make particularized duties with regard to the foreseeability of certain work situations. If you have continual work situations where you've decided to create the conditions that will put fatigue in your employees based on the conditions of the working employment as it's set forth.
So a law firm who requires one of its lawyers to work all night to get ready for an oral argument before the Supreme Court, that would be a situation, wouldn't it, where the fatigue would be a factor, and perhaps you're going home after working all night, and you're in an accident. Does the law firm have a duty to the public in that instance to warn you or train you about, you know, if you work all night, you're going to be tired. You maybe should stay in the office.
Well, you may have a different duty in that situation. If it's an emergency situation, maybe the responsibility of the employer is to provide transportation. I'll reimburse you to take a taxi home. It's, if you are creating a dangerous situation, then you have a responsibility to take reasonable steps to prevent the danger that arises from that situation.
Who created the dangerous situation? The guy could have slept there on site. So didn't he create the dangerous situation by taking off for an hour drive?
Well, the dangerous situation was created when he was in the course and scope of his employment. He was fatigued while he was in the course and scope of his employment.
Well, that does sound like you're doing what opposing counsel said. You're asking jurors to set what working hours can be for any business.
No, Your Honor, I'm not, because the duty that you're placing upon the employer is not to take absolute control of the employees. It's not to say that everything that the employee does outside the course and scope of his employment is causing you to be held liable. What we're saying is you have a responsibility to take reasonable steps. What they're saying are all the steps are unreasonable. We can't, it's just impossible burden because there's nothing we can do. Therefore, we should never be held responsible for fatigue because fatigue is something we can't do anything about. So we have no burden, no duty in that case. And under their explanation, if they worked somebody for 48 straight hours, they would have no duty. But their own conduct shows that they think they do have a duty, because one thing they are providing is places to sleep. That is one thing they are providing.
We should fault them because they took that extra step.
No, Your Honor, you shouldn't fault them. They took part of the step. The part they didn't take was then to explain to their employees why they need to be staying on or
Tell me what this training course would have been like. We're going to train our employees that you shouldn't drive home a long way when you're tired and might fall asleep at the wheel. What's that going to be?
Your Honor, there's actually training materials put out by NHTSA that are part of the record. They do exist.
They drivers training things where we show smashed up cars.
I'm not sure that it does like a driver's education course, but it does talk about, it teaches about circadian rhythms and how you understand your circadian rhythms. Something that was stated in court today is a misunderstanding of that issue. They're claiming, well, if he would have he would have said, my circadian rhythms haven't been disturbed, so I must be okay to drive at 6 o'clock in the morning. But the truth of the matter is, your circadian rhythms have you asleep at the time he was driving. That's one thing that wasn't understood in this court today. That's one thing that the training would show, that at certain times of the day, you want to be asleep. And those are dangerous times to drive if you are sleep impaired.
I'm wondering the program. Well, in the driver's ed program, of course, we do these things primarily to try to get teenage boys to slow down. And we know how good that works since they're the most expensive drivers to insure. Why do we think this is going to change teenage, 19-year-old young men's behavior if we sit them down in a class and make them watch this movie about circadian rhythms? Do we really? Is this just something, a hoop we need to jump over so the lawyers won't bother us, or do we really think that's going to do any good?
Your Honor, I really hope it does good. There's 100,000 accidents every year because of fatigued drivers. Shift workers make up 20% of the drivers. They make up 50% of those accidents. Every year, 1,500 of those accidents have fatalities.
This accident
alone had five fatalities.
I agree. There's a lot of, there's nothing more dangerous you can do in America than driving a car. But the problem is, Americans want to drive in cars. And if we tell them they can't, because we want you to be safe, they're going to throw us all out of office. Because it's a free country and they want to drive cars and that kind of stuff. And so we pass laws saying, okay, you can't drive drunk, to try to stop them, try to make them stop. But you're basically saying we're going to have to tell these folks they work your 12 hours, that's fine, and then you can't go home. We're going to make you stay here. Because while you're just saying, well, they just have to have a training program, the next case will just say, well, they have to have a better training program.
Your Honor,
Where are we going to stop short of telling them you must keep your employees imprisoned after they work and not let them go anywhere?
Nobody in this case ever said anything like that. That was not what any of the experts
said.
But if
we make that rule, how can we stop anywhere short?
You can make the rule based on the duty of this case and the facts of the case, which are that if they had provided a training program, which talks about more than circadian rhythms, it also talks about countermeasures and how you cannot be fatigued when you come into shift work. This is an important issue societally when we talk about some of the duty issues. This is an important issue. It really is. And I think to say, oh, well, training makes no difference is, I mean, then why would we have training in
It's like the Seagram case. I mean, drinking alcohol excessively is a very important issue. Thousands of people die in the country every year from it, but we said in Seagram's, that doesn't mean distillers have to put on the bottle. Drinking can be bad for your health because, basically, any fool knows that. And doesn't anybody know if you've worked all night, driving the next morning for an hour, there's a severe danger?
Your Honor, I don't think people know that. I don't think that they understand that fatigue puts the same type of impairments on you that alcohol does. I don't think they understand that there are certain times that it's worse.
Do you have any evidence to support any study to show that, or is that just what
that
your
is? There are studies, and that's part of the. It's with the experts.
People don't know. Your expert thought people don't know that they could fall asleep after they worked all night.
Well, I don't think it says that, Your Honor. I think that there's studies that show that people aren't completely aware of what fatigue is, and there's reasons we have the training programs is to try to make people aware of things they're not currently aware of. But also to talk about this duty issue, you mentioned the alcohol, but when this court held in El Chico that you could have a duty with regard to alcohol, they didn't say don't allow the patron to drive off if they're intoxicated. The duty was don't serve them anymore. So,
what is your response to the chief's earlier question about any evidence in the record empirically about prior fatigue-related accidents either on the job site or as people are leaving the job site going home?
There was no evidence I know of. There was evidence that they actually check for fatigue before somebody goes on duty to try to prevent fatigue-related accidents that happen during the course and scope of employment.
Do you know how long Neighbors Drilling has had shift work on its plant site there?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, and I'm also not sure when they switched to 12-hour shifts.
Aside from this case, though, you're unaware of any other fatigue-related accident, even on the job site, much less off the job site.
Your Honor, I'm kind of like this court. I'm kind of limited to the record, and I didn't try to go do extra research on something that would be outside the record.
But the record shows no other.
Not that I know of, Your Honor. I didn't try to do anything in addition to that.
Counsel, if in fact we go with your theory of no training, and if we assume this young man made it to home and assume he picked up his girlfriend to drive her to school the next day, and they stopped off and had breakfast and then drove on a little further and they had a wreck, is Neighbors still responsible for that in your view? Where do we stop?
I think that you could have
responsibility under circumstances like this.
I think you have superseding intervening issues, which are actually raised in almost all the other cases that are the Otis fatigue cases. They all had these hours of delay between sometimes they actually went and started drinking alcohol and stopped off and shot pool for a couple hours and drank beer. And the courts were finding, well, there's no duty, but I think that it's probably makes just as much sense to say at a certain point, when you're not on the direct route out, if you've had enough time and you've done something else, that you've had a break in that chain and that you wouldn't have responsibility for that.
But the fatigue you're talking about and his knowledge of the fatigue you want us to impose a duty to train about is going to continue unabated until he rests, it seems like.
His fatigue will continue, yes, Your Honor.
So where do we stop that then? You say once he goes and stops at his first stop, if he stops at home after an hour, changes clothes, and then goes on down the road, we stop it once he gets home and changes clothes, and Neighbors is not responsible for anything after that?
Well, I would think that that would be a natural progression, that it has to be related to fatigue that's actually from the work side. If you've been out doing stuff for another hour or hour and a half, and then it gets the fatigue from that happened on the work side is not.
At home, changes clothes, washes his face and goes to pick up his girlfriend, still down the road, still tired, doesn't sleep, he stops for 15 minutes and does it quick because he wants to see his girlfriend. Picks up his girlfriend, they eat breakfast, he's still not sleeping, he's still got this fatigue, it's building and building and building, and they have a wreck at that point on the way to school. Neighbors are still responsible for that? Or where in there, we've never, where do we cut it off once we start making them responsible?
I think that, like I said, I think there's natural lines, and I think that once he gets where he's...
Where is it in that case? When he hits home and changes...
I would say when he got home, in that case, that would be...
Why?
Because I think that at that point, it would be just a causation issue of a decision...
Because he chose not to stay there and go to sleep, but he chose on his own volition to go somewhere else? What other reason could there be?
I guess that would essentially be the reason that he at that point had other things that came into it. I think most of it would be a timing issue, that as long as he hadn't been at the work site for a certain amount of time, which in that case, and maybe I misunderstood the hypothetical on that, then that would be a proper
time. Did I hear you say
time.
A minute or so ago that employers ought to be on the hook only for job-related or job-created or job-induced fatigue?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if they came to the work site, they'd been up all night playing poker or heaven knows what, they'd been up all night, they arrived worn out and fatigued, worked 12 hours, there'd be no duty by the employer?
There would be no duty because it wasn't caused by the employment. And that's not what we have in this case, by the way. And the evidence is in this case that he woke up between 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning before the shift, left about 4 o'clock.
Well, no, you would say there's still a duty. You would just say there's no causation.
Well, it depends on how we define
it. If your argument is you've got a duty to tell your people about fatigue, that's a duty that applies before and after they get hurt,
and whether
they show up in good shape or not.
Let me rephrase. If it were the situation of neighbors, then that would actually be true, because the duty would arise because of the work conditions themselves, that you have foreseeable knowledge that because of the working conditions that you place your employees under, that they will be fatigued at the end because of being in that course of stuff.
It's going to be foreseeable that some of your employees don't take care of themselves or didn't have a good night's sleep. I mean, that's always foreseeable.
And in cases, sometimes we have to leave certain things to the juries to decide foreseeability and causation of cases. I don't think that we should run away from ever finding that anybody ever has a duty, because it might be in some cases that there would be a foreseeability issue.
Any court ever said there's this duty regarding sleep? I didn't see one in the Court of Appeals opinion.
And there's in Texas, there's no case that's held on this.
Any case anywhere?
There are cases that have held on duties with regard to fatigue. One of them is the LeMaster case out of West Virginia. There's a case called Faverty out of Oregon. Those are all both cited in the briefing.
But this would be a new duty in Texas.
It would be, with regard to the fatigue part, it would be new in Texas. It would be recognizing the same duty that the court recognized in the Love case,
right,
which is you create the condition that you have the duty to take responsibility to take reasonable steps to prevent the accident.
A lot of employers out there, this would be a big surprise to them to find out that they have a duty to protect against fatigue. I mean, you think of the law enforcement industry, sector, medical providers, all these people who work long shifts, and many at night, their employers would have this duty.
You might be surprised how many already trained their employees in that respect, as peace
question,
officers.
Question, but
I believe
that
I think that they may not think of it that way as a legal obligation. I don't know that it would necessarily be that astounding to people to realize that they have an obligation if they make somebody stay up. If in the hypothetical of somebody working all night, that if I said I'm too tired and I need a taxi ride home, that they're going to reimburse that person. I don't think that would be something they currently think would be out of the realm of ordinary. Do they think of it as being a legal duty? I'm not sure exactly how businesses think, but they may not. But again, I don't know that the nightclub in the Love case really thought that they had a legal duty with regard to the intoxication of the independent contractor for them. So, I mean, the fact that we have to have duties, because certain people have a better ability to be responsible for preventing the accident. And
okay. But you don't see this as any way like the Otis duty or the Iani context, where the employer is not exercising any control of the employee off the premises?
I don't see it as that kind of duty. It's not, although I do see it as the one way that Otis is analogous is that I see it as a very particularized duty in this case. What we're talking about are the facts of this case and whether Neighbors Drilling had a duty in this case. My time is essentially up, so unless there's other questions.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Ross.
Thank you.
There is, of course, nothing wrong with having a training program. There's nothing wrong with telling people, reminding them about what they already know. Just like there was everything wrong in Loram when the employer encouraged its employees to use methamphetamine to meet the grueling hours. But neither should be a basis for civil liability for many of the reasons that have prompted the questions from this court. No way to draw lines. There's no way to cabin this duty. There are cases already that were filed where duty was rejected that didn't deal with drilling companies. Moore versus Dallas Times Herald was a computer specialist. Computer malfunctioned, and he had to come in late. National Convenience Stores versus Mathern. Somebody who was working long hours, I think they were shorthanded at the convenience store. So there's no way of stopping this duty. And when you boil it down, what they're arguing for is training. Because otherwise, Texas law doesn't fit into their duty analysis. And there simply is no duty to train about what we already know.
Counsel, I know that, I recall that the trial judge granted a post-trial motion setting aside the verdict because he determined there was no duty. Does question number one in the charge essentially give the inquiry as to whether there was a duty to the jury? I mean, if you look at the question, it's a standard negligence question. Did the negligence of any of those named below approximately cause the occurrence in question? Typical negligence question. But then the instructions seem to track duty questions.
Yes. In fact, the first time we learned that we needed to submit sometimes duty questions, I believe it's Justice O'Neill's opinion in Torrington, where the court said, sometimes you have to ask predicate questions to the jury. There may be factual predicates to decide duty. Now, one of the things we argue at question one, it doesn't have the right duty prongs in there. It doesn't have actual knowledge of the incapacity, which is what was required by Otis, and that was one of the objections that was made at trial. But it does, in effect, ask some predicate questions relevant to duty.
But it doesn't ask for answers to the predicate questions. It asks for an answer to the negligence approximately caused the occurrence question.
That's correct.
And so you don't know what the jury's answers were to the predicate
That's
questions,
correct.
Which are instructions here. And I guess the trial judge recognized that was a legal, the question of duty is a legal issue, not for the jury, because he ruled as he did post-trial. Wouldn't you normally expect this duty question to be determined by the judge pre-trial?
Well, in fact, Judge Murray, he's now retired, stated in probably in his letter to counsel, saying he was going to grant the judgment notwithstanding the verdict, that he realized sometime during trial that there, if I'm remembering this correctly, sometime during trial that this they weren't going to be able to make their case. But he decided to go ahead and let the case go to the jury and then afterwards decided to grant the judgment notwithstanding the verdict. And I think here there can be predicate questions to duty. Here there was no evidence supporting, I think, the only cause of action that this court has recognized in third-party cases. There's absolutely no evidence anybody had knowledge of his incapacity. There is no evidence that any control was exercised after that knowledge was gained. And I disagree on this creation of danger. There was no danger created by the job. He didn't run over anybody or change lanes during the job. It's afterwards, after he left the work. And the creation of duty in Otis Engineering was taking control of someone you know is incapacitated and say, it's time for you to go home. I'm going to walk you to your car and you go on home. So there's a creation of duty in the Otis facts. The Otis law is what should apply here, and the facts simply do not support a duty in this case. And for those reasons, Judge Murray's judgment notwithstanding the verdict should be reinstated.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
Oyez, 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 the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.